we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Show, Western Canada's only radio program focusing on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is CFRO 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, Vancouver, Canada. Today is Friday, July 14th, 2017. For the next hour, I'm your host, Jen Dobell, and I'm joined in studio by my animal-loving vegan co-host, Allison Cole.
Hi there.
And our animal-loving vegan guest co-host, Jillian Walters.
Hi.
So today we want to talk a little bit about the Liberation Pledge. A lot of people don't know what that is. So Jillian, can you just explain that to our listeners?
The Liberation Pledge, which I took this week, is one, that I publicly refuse to eat animals, live vegan. Two, that I publicly refuse to sit where animals are being eaten. And three, I encourage others to take the pledge.
So let's talk about the three of us here. What stance do we all have on the Liberation Pledge? Let's start with you, Allison.
Well, I don't know how long this Liberation Pledge has formally been around for, but I had already sort of made a commitment to myself years ago, and it came through an evolution of me first becoming vegetarian many, many years ago, like 23, 24 years ago. And at that time, I was a person who didn't eat meat. I ate dairy and eggs, and I also worked in cafeterias making meat sandwiches for people and serving meat, and it didn't bother me because that's what I was used to. Now, I have evolved a lot since then. I've since gone vegan about 11 years ago, and of course, when you go vegetarian and then vegan, you just become so sensitized, right, to issues and to what the bodies of dead animals mean and to what it means to you watching other people eat those dead animals. So I have to say, like, I sort of have my own Liberation Pledge, but it's not super strict, but just to, in all practicality. But honestly, like, I really try to avoid eating at a table where there's other people who are consuming meat or any dead animal products, because it honestly, just because it disgusts me and it makes me sad. And I think that's maybe where you two are coming from as well. But of course, I do have situations where sometimes I'll be at a workplace and I go and actually sit at a table by myself, and then someone comes to sit next to me and starts with their tray full of meat. And then what are you going to do, right?
So there are situations where I find it's complicated as well, which is why I haven't taken that firm stance.
That's the world, right? That's the world we live in. And trying to find a balance between being a complete outcast from society, but still trying to fit in and actually leading by example.
Right.
Right.
So Jillian, how about you? What's your stance?
Well, I've been vegan for such a long time. But this, I just learned about this last week, and I thought this would be a way to just be more firm. Like, as a vegan, I have sat at thousands of tables over the years where animals are being consumed, and the only way I could cope with it was to disconnect. So I'd have to shut off a part of me to the smell, to the visions I had in my head of what horror the animal had gone through, and I had to quiet that part of me that wanted to scream and make the people see how insane this was. And to watch family and friends discuss how delicious an animal is can be intolerable. So the pledge for me really is making it more public and standing. It makes me feel like I can be more...
Well,
you're more firm. You know, more firm. More self-confident.
I was surprised to just learn that you actually made a public announcement about this, because you said a few people weren't so happy. And it was like, oh, how did they know? Did you announce it? And you said, why, yes, I did.
Yeah, I publicly posted it on my Facebook page, and it stated, "Today I am stating my refusal to eat where animals are being eaten. I know animals of many species, human, dog, cat, cow, pig, chicken, fish, and I respect and love them all. For this reason, from this point on, I will treat the body of any animal the same and refuse to participate in meals where animal bodies are being eaten." I noticed after I wrote that there was quite a few comments. One beautiful human was inspired and took the pledge herself. And there was a lot of other comments as well. A few seemed to take my pledge as a judgment against their choice to eat animals.
Let's talk about that a little bit. I was part of, well, I saw your post and of course congratulated you, and I said, let's get fork bracelets. And I don't know, we didn't say this. The people who take the Liberation Pledge wear a fork as a bracelet so that everybody knows. And I like that because it stimulates a conversation in an everyday environment. So let's talk about the comments. You had a lot of positive stuff from vegans, of course, and maybe even some non-vegan positive comments. But one friend in particular said, I'm going to have a pig roast tonight. Yummy. Which we are no stranger to. And for people who are listening today that are not vegan animal rights activists, this is the kind of stuff we deal with multiple times on a daily basis. This attack from non-vegans who feel that they are being attacked when they're not.
I call it ignorance.
It's so annoying. So that went into, that went on until midnight last night. It was going on for hours, and all your vegan friends dogpiled this person with some truth and defense of you. And
yeah,
I thought it was really interesting. In the end, I think he felt that he was not being very mature emotionally about it, and that he was not recognizing that it was just a perceived threat and that he was behaving childishly. And I actually clicked on his photo to think, who is this guy? It must be some young person that's just not emotionally developed yet. But he wasn't. He was someone probably in his 50s.
Yeah.
Newsflash, Jen, some people in their 50s aren't emotionally developed yet.
I know. I was surprised.
And men in their 40s, I'll put that out there.
Yeah, and also it just reminded me of the way that non-vegans might use sarcasm or humor as kind of a statement that they feel uncomfortable. Maybe they don't know what else to say, but it's offensive.
And it doesn't help the movement of liberating animals. That's the main thing. I can handle the heckling. I've got thick enough skin. But what bothers me is that it seems that the majority of the population laughs about animal abuse. And that is a serious issue. And I feel like saying, why don't you sit down and watch a slaughterhouse video and then see if you want to come up to me and say, let's have a pig roast. Yummy.
I think people laugh as a defense mechanism because they really don't want to think about it. So what do you do when you're in an awkward, nervous situation when something presents you that you actually don't want to think about? People laugh.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I think that's why a lot of us take the Liberation Pledge, where we don't sit at a table with people, because if we think that there's going to be a discussion about our veganism as the only vegan at the table, and we know that a majority of the time we get those kinds of comments, first of all, we're sick of it and we don't want to sit there and have our meal be disrupted with that kind of a debate. And I didn't give my answer yet on my stance on the Liberation Pledge, so I'll just say now, I'm really on the fence, because there's times with my family I absolutely do not sit at a table where there's any animal products, and they think that it's okay if there's cheese or milk on the table. They don't understand that that's a bad industry. I don't want to witness it. And I think they know better. I've given them a lot of education and they don't respond to me. So that bothers me. When it comes to dating a new person and I'm meeting their family, I feel like if I took the Liberation Pledge, that would make vegans look bad. It would make me look bad because they don't get it yet. So I'm on the fence. I feel like sometimes I would definitely take a hard line on it, and other times I would be more strategic.
That's why there's three levels of...
Oh, let's hear about the three levels.
Yeah, it's more... It sounds so drastic, but it's actually very inclusive, and there's room for... It's adaptable. So there's this really good article by Orlando Torres, hope I'm pronouncing that right, called Making the Liberation Pledge Work for You. And he suggests three levels. Level one, you just refuse to be in a vegan or a non-vegan restaurant. That would be the hardest, especially for people that don't live in people that live in urban areas.
Or if they're out with staff, right?
Yeah. Level two is you just don't. You only sit at a vegan table, so you can go to a place that serves meat, but you only sit at a vegan table. Mm-hmm. And level three is no corpses on the table. So it could be a vegetarian table, for example, like you were discussing, Jen.
Vegan table for me.
Yeah, but I mean, if there's dairy, like if you wanted to be more adaptable and you're going to visit friends that still have cheese on the table.
Right.
And then what about level four for people like me who try all of the above, but then some other, you know, well-meaning coworkers sit down with me to try to keep me company and they have corpses on their table? What do I do? Get
tricky.
Up and leave?
Exactly. It is tricky, right? And how does that make you seem as such an intolerant person?
I can identify with what you think, Jillian, just like sort of trying to desensitize yourself and not look at the dead bodies there and just try, like, I have so much like going on in my head and I'm screaming inside and they're just enjoying their meal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not easy.
Did you want to say anything else about the Liberation Pledge? We just have another minute here. Or?
I think just I encourage people to take it. And there's a really good website called the Liberation Pledge. And there's lots of information there, lots of support. And it's very adaptable.
And I do think that, you know, even if the people are wearing that fork bracelet, imagine the number of discussions that come up in their life about veganism. That's really advantageous.
Yeah.
Okay. So later on in the show, we will be playing an interview with Dr. Ray Greek. So just stay tuned for that in just a minute. He is a anesthesiologist from Los Angeles. He's the president of the nonprofit Americans for Medical Advancement. And he's been a professor at two U.S. medical schools and has co-authored numerous books on the topic of animal research. And he is trying to get the world to be aware of the fact that animal research for human diseases is totally ineffective. And of course, us being animal rights activists, we're very happy to hear this. And we hope that the scientists start to pay attention to this and change their methods. And we'll hear from that interview in just a minute.
Hey there, Co-op Radio listeners. Do you like food? Of course you do. Would you like to learn more about food? Why not? Well, then tune in every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio, where we talk all about food, sourcing food, buying food, the politics of food, hey, even cooking food. Food, glorious food. Listen every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
So we're now going to listen to an interview with Dr. Ray Greek, an anesthesiologist and president of the nonprofit Americans for Medical Advancement. He's going to be speaking about animal research and how that is not effective in finding cures for human diseases and how it has, in fact, put us decades behind finding cures for human diseases. Let's listen to that now. So, Dr. Greek, can you please introduce yourself and your credentials?
Oh, sure. My name is Ray Greek. I'm a medical doctor from the state of California, and for the last 20 years, I've been doing research on the use of animals in science, specifically the use of animals to try and cure or prevent human disease.
And what is your opinion on the use of animals to find cures for human diseases?
It's unfortunately a waste of time and money, and it's directly harming human patients. Animals and humans are different evolved systems. They're complex systems. They do have some things in common, but in terms of how diseases and drugs act when human beings are exposed to them, they react very, very differently. So it's unfortunately not just a waste of money, but it's misleading, and human patients have died because of this.
And what is your greatest motivation with regards to your efforts to expose this truth?
Well, my wife is a veterinarian and I am a physician, and we both love animals. Of course, we both come from families. We have families. We love people. So this is a way to help both humans and animals at the same time. Obviously, the animals are suffering in the use of animals in research, and humans are also suffering because of this.
And you've stated that animal testing has slowed down the scientific advancement. Why is it then that scientists continue to use animals for human diseases?
Well, in a word, money. But really what you're fighting when you try and change the use of animals in medical research is the status quo. The use of animals in research and testing is a multi-billion dollar business. And anytime you have a multi-billion dollar business, you're going to have lobbyists, you're going to have people who make a lot of money from this. You're going to have the status quo. So it's going to be very, very hard to get society to change. And now the government actually supports animal experimentation. The government requires animal experimentation. So you're fighting the status quo, just like you're fighting against global warming or whatever. You're up against the status quo and the vested interest groups.
And what role does human emotion play in the resistance to abandon animal testing?
Oh, it plays a big role. A lot of the people who have made their careers out of animal-based research and animal testing, they have egos just like everybody else, and they're smart people, and they'll fight very hard to defend their career choice and to defend their role in the whole animal experimentation industry. Guilt, ironically, is another reason why some people will defend animal experimentation. I had one woman at a lecture come up to me after my lecture and say, "But Dr. Greek, if everything you say is true, why did I kill all those rabbits?" So there's a lot of human emotion that play at this, and you combine that with all the money that's involved, and this is going to be a very difficult thing to stop.
Yeah, I do find that when it comes to advocacy, a lot of people are avoiding looking bad and being wrong, and certainly that does play into the human emotion and the ego, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, wouldn't one think that if scientists could obtain better and more accurate results without using animals, then they would want to, because then they could sell more drugs that would be more effective?
Well, if you've spent the last quarter of a century of your life learning how to experiment on animals, and your entire education has been geared towards someday experimenting on animals, that's not something you're just going to abandon despite or because of evidence. Okay, and this is where the human emotions come into play. If you are so attached because of your education and your upbringing and everything else to using animals, little things like facts, unfortunately, are not going to convince you. Okay, humans are not rational people. We are irrational beings. Evolution made us that way. So it is very difficult for people who have grown up in the system and are now part of the system to just abandon the system just because the facts are now against them.
Mm-hmm. Well, as far back as 2008, the Globe and Mail reported that there's a robotic machinery that can test more possible toxins in one afternoon with greater accuracy than 30 years of animal testing could supply. Why isn't this machinery being used more frequently?
Well, some people want this machinery to be used, and even the pharmaceutical companies want this machinery to be used. But right now, most people do not make money from using this machinery. Most people involved in this debate make money from using animals. So you have a very, very large number of people with a lot of money at stake who want the animal model to continue, okay? And again, this is not rational on their part. They have families. They should be wanting the best testing methods that are available. But when it comes down to possibly, when it comes down to possibly losing something in the future versus losing your paycheck today, most people will risk the future.
Like many politicians.
Exactly.
Is it required by law that drugs be tested on animals prior to being tested on humans and then eventually released for public use?
The short answer is yes. The way drugs are developed is regulated on a worldwide basis. So the same rules and regulations that we have in the United States are really also applied in Japan, Canada, Europe, and so forth. And so anytime one country has a drug company that wants to develop a drug, they are subject to those same rules and regulations. And animal testing is a part of that. Now, interestingly, most of the time the drug companies just ignore the animal tests, or they specifically pick a species of animal that will respond the way they want the animal to respond. If you test 10 different drugs on 100 different species of animals, you'll get a shotgun pattern in terms of how the animals react. Some of the animals will react favorably, some of the animals will die, and so you don't have any idea beforehand which animal species will react the way you want it to. But the governments allow pharmaceutical companies to only submit the data that goes along with what they want to do. So if they want their drug to look good, then they will only submit data from animal models that made their drug look good. They will not submit data from the animals that died, for example, when they took the drug.
Well, I'm not a member of the scientific community, but that makes me lose faith in scientists when I hear that. That does not seem very scientific.
Science is the best paradigm we have ever found for discovering truths about the universe. That having been said, human beings are the ones who actually practice science. Human beings are the ones that actually go in the lab or make the observations or whatever. And human beings are greatly flawed. Human beings are greedy. They only have their self-interest at heart. We are not a very model species in terms of our ethics and morality. So science works. Science is a good thing. It's the human beings that are implementing the science and then implementing the policies in government that are the problem.
It's interesting. Well, what do identical human twins tell us about research using animals? You had an interesting story about this in your lecture last night.
Yes, thank you. So we know, and we have known for many decades, that identical twins do not always respond the same way to drugs, nor do they always suffer from the same diseases. And these are individuals that are as nearly genetically identical as any two things on Earth. So if identical twins do not always respond the same way to drugs or suffer from the same diseases, how on Earth can we expect one species, for example, a mouse, to inform us about drug reactions in another species, for example, a human being? If you only understand that, if you only understand that one twin does not always predict what the second twin will do in terms of drugs and disease, then you really understand why animal models are going to fail.
It's a great example, and I think that will help our non-scientific audience to understand how better to debate with people against the use of animal testing. And can you now explain what is personalized medicine, and please explain that again for the non-scientific audience?
Sure, that's a very good question. And again, this also, like the question about the twins, goes back to why animal experimentation does not work in terms of translating to cures for human disease. What we have always tried to do in medicine is predict what a drug is going to do to you. And we failed at that. We know, for example, that if I give you an antibiotic, there's about a 99% chance that it will be effective, and there's a very small chance that it will cause a dangerous side effect. But that's not 100%. And every year, people die because an antibiotic was not effective or because they suffered a catastrophic side effect that we did not anticipate. So just because a drug works 99% of the time does not mean that it's going to be good for you. What personalized medicine seeks to do is to look at your genes and match your genes to a very specific drug that is going to be used to treat your disease. You don't care if that drug worked on me. You don't care if that drug had side effects in me. You want to know what is that drug going to do for you. And so that's what personalized medicine is. Even humans cannot predict for other humans how they're going to respond to drugs and disease. So again, this goes back to using an entirely different species to try and figure out how you or I are going to respond to a drug or disease. It just gets more ludicrous the more you know about personalized medicine, the more you know about genetics and identical twins. The animal model is a relic from the 19th century, and we need to abandon it.
If I had cancer or some other very frightening disease that threatened my life, I would want personalized medicine. How readily available is that for somebody in that situation right now?
Right now, we have over 150 drugs that will not be prescribed until the doctor prescribing the medication knows your specific genetic profile. And one of the biggest areas that has benefited from this is cancer treatment. We now give certain drugs to people and not to other people because of their genetic makeup. So the biggest advances, the biggest benefits in personalized medicine have arguably been in the treatment of various cancers. This is revolutionizing cancer treatment, and it is the future of all treatments for all diseases. The future would get here a lot sooner if we weren't wasting money on animal modeling and animal experimentation. But this is where our research dollars should be going. This is not futuristic. We are doing it right now. There's over 150 drugs that personalized medicine is already available for. But we would like to have personalized medicine available for every drug, every patient, every gene, and every disease. And that is doable. That's not Star Trek medicine. That is absolutely possible.
Well, speaking of that, tell us about the profitability of the animal testing industry.
The animal model industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. There are a lot of people that draw their paycheck every week just because of the animal model industry. And there are whole companies, some public, some private, that are devoted to nothing but selling animals for research, selling the bedding and the food for the animals, and so on and so on. So anytime you get a multi-billion dollar industry, they're going to have some clout with the federal government. And because of that clout, animal modeling continues.
Well, within your scientific community, are you a bit of a black sheep, a minority, or are there others who share your views on wanting to abandon animal testing?
Boy, that really depends on who you ask. If you ask other physicians, for the most part, know that animal modeling doesn't work. Okay, we learned that in medical school when we saw that a mouse reacted one way to a drug and our patients on the clinics did not react the same way. So most physicians are very suspicious of animal modeling. They think it's a waste of time, and they're on my side. Of course, if you're referring to the scientific community and the PhDs who are involved in the animal modeling, no. Among them, I am a pariah. They do not want to hear from me. They do not want me to come to their university. They do not want me to be published as I am in the scientific literature. No, among them, I'm definitely a black sheep.
Well, after all that I've learned from you, it seems obvious that we need to abandon animal testing. How are we going to get there, and what timeline do you foresee with regards to this goal?
Boy, it's hard to predict the future, but I can tell you this. Over the 20 years that I've been involved in this, I'm seeing more and more people, mainly from the pharmaceutical community, but quite a few people in the basic research community, saying all the things that I am saying. And for all the same reasons. So I think scientifically, we have never had better arguments than we have today for the abandonment of animal experimentation. So if you're a scientist, if you're a physician, if you're an engineer, if you're in any of the STEM fields, I would encourage you to learn more about this issue and use your scientific expertise and influence on society. But even if you're a non-scientist, you should probably familiarize yourself with this issue, because you can help. You can definitely help out. I wrote a book about 7 years ago called FAQs about the use of animals in science, and that was written for non-scientists so that the non-scientist can discuss with his or her family, friends, his or her peer group, the questions about animal experimentation. And so if somebody is interested in this topic and reads that book, I don't make any money from the book. All the profits go to my charity, Americans for Medical Advancement. So if people read that, they can have a very good armamentarium in terms of arguing with their peer group. Now, don't try and argue with scientists, because the scientist has a lot more education than you do, and you're probably not going to win that argument. But then again, you can call me, and I can do a debate with that scientist. That probably won't happen. Most scientists are not going to debate me on this issue, because they simply don't have the facts. But I would encourage everybody to read the FAQs book. Again, I don't make any money from it, but it's a very good book. It's written for laymen to communicate with other non-scientists, and that's where I would start.
So beyond reading your book, and thank you for donating a copy to me, I will read that. What can animal rights advocates do to effectively debate with lay people beyond that? Are there documentaries that you know of that people can recommend? Are there online resources that we can recommend to people who may be having this argument with us?
So if you're a layman, it's very difficult to comprehend all of the science. And the FAQs book is the best resource that I know about. I do not know of any documentaries on this. People have told me that I should make a documentary on this, put it on YouTube, make it available. I have not done that yet, but some of these things cost money, and anyway, I just haven't gotten around to doing it, and I don't know of anyone else that has gotten around to doing it either. There are videos on YouTube about why animal modeling is bad. Some of those are good. Some of them, the science is pretty suspect. I would probably, again, I know this sounds egotistical, but I would probably read that FAQs book, because I know that information is scientifically accurate, and it's a fairly easy book to read.
Well, great. And just to wrap up, I wonder if there's anything that I've missed that you hear about being some of the most common arguments against or in defense of animal testing that I've missed today that maybe you want to just discuss.
I'll tell you one thing that I have not discussed on my trip to British Columbia. And that is the use of critical thinking. A vast majority of the arguments that the animal experimentation community makes are nonsensical arguments. They're fallacies, or they're based on what are called cognitive biases, or heuristics. And so the other thing that if a person is interested in this, you can go to YouTube and find a lot of videos about critical thinking. And if the average animal activist knew more about critical thinking, he could actually argue with vivisectors, because most of what the vivisectors say is fallacious. In other words, it's irrational. The premise does not match the conclusion. So it's just a matter of logic. Most of the arguments that the vivisectors use are illogical. And if you point that out to them, they will get very frustrated and very angry, and usually you will make a fool out of them. That's probably a second interview, but again, there are some very good videos on YouTube. Look at critical thinking.
And are there any videos anywhere of you arguing with a vivisector?
There are some videos of me arguing with a vivisector. I don't remember the URLs off the top of my head, but you can Google Ray Greek Debate Animal, and that should bring up some videos.
That sounds interesting. And for those who don't know what vivisection is, can you explain that?
Vivisection is literally the cutting up of the living, and that's what animal experimentation was called in the 1800s. The animal experimenters themselves called themselves vivisectors. Today, it is considered an insulting term to animal experimenters. I still use it because they're the ones that came up with it. They're the ones that assigned it to themselves. And so that's why I continue to use it. Once you tell the world that you are a X, you're an X. That term has stuck. So okay. That's why I use it.
And I use it as well. I didn't realize that it was not favorable by them. But one more thing I want to bring up, just in case our listeners have never seen any graphic footage or images of animal testing. Can you describe for us how these animals are living in labs and what kinds of things are done to them, just in case they're under the impression that it's more humane than it is?
It's far from humane. Probably the best example I can give you is just a theoretical example. If you were a researcher using animals and you wanted to burn a pig with a blowtorch over 50% of its body without using any anesthesia, you could do that.
Wow.
And in fact, burn experiments do things like that all the time. The neurological things that we do to animals is just amazing. It's horrendous. And if you just Google vivisection and look under images, you'll see way more than you want to see.
Why would they do that without anesthesia? Are they just...
Some scientists think that the anesthetic will interfere with the results of the experiment. And again, there's very little to support that scientifically. In my opinion, they do it because they can.
Okay, I'm glad you left us with that thought so that it calls us into action to advocate for these animals. And I will definitely be reading your book, and I hope everyone else does. Again, what is the title of the book?
FAQs About the Use of Animals in Science.
Fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Ray Greek, for being with us here today.
Thank you.
Okay, take care.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO, 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
And now for some events. This Sunday, July 16th, from 5:30 to 9, the Vancouver Animal Advocates are gathering for a potluck. Please see our website for more information. I will be facilitating a 10-week group called the Vegan Kids Club starting on September 13th. It will run for 10 weeks. It will be a space for young vegans to learn about activism, food, health, and self-care. I will have more details as we get closer to fall, but please follow me or the Animal Voices Vancouver website.
That would be you, Jillian Walters.
That would be me.
On like Facebook?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Thanks. And pretty exciting, Vegetoria next weekend, July 22nd at Centennial Square in Victoria from 12 to 5. Local animal rights lawyer Anna Pippis will be there, as well as the veganizer James Aspie from Australia. bring your non-vegan friends. He is a pro at veganizing.
Yeah, watch him on YouTube. I just had to interject. Look up James Asby on YouTube. He can veganize anyone. Sorry, Jillian.
Yeah, I just posted a couple of his videos. They're awesome.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to remind people that tomorrow night, we've been talking about this event for a while now, it's Night of the Neophytes. So what is that, you might ask? Well, it's an event that's being organized just for general awareness of animal rights issues and advocacy and veganism. And it will be featuring actually an evening of six lady bands, as it is announced, and also a catered vegan dinner by Plant-Based Food and Specialties that had to be pre-ordered. And there's also going to be a talk by Anna Pippas. Once again, she's our local animal rights lawyer, and I'm not sure exactly what she'll be talking about, but I think it'll be interesting, whatever it is. There's been a lot that she's been involved with lately in the news. And so there will be performances by bands called The Furniture, the SHIT Talkers, the Daisy Stranglers, Sinead Sanders from Animal Voices, Beaverette, Siobhan Duvall. So that's happening tomorrow night at Pat's Pub in Vancouver. Tickets are only $10. It's just a regular cover charge at the door, and you get all that music. It starts, doors open at 7 p.m. tomorrow night. And I hope to see you there. It's going to be really good. So if you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
And now for some news and discussion. After speaking with the SPCA and the RCMP yesterday, I was reminded that it is illegal to break into a car to save an animal in distress. There are, however, a list of actions you can make if you observe a pet in a hot car. First, note the license plate and vehicle information and observe the animal. Second, ask managers of nearby businesses to page the owner to return to their vehicle immediately. Thirdly, if no owner is found, call the BCSPCA Provincial Call Center at 1-855-622-7722 and also dial 911. Only special provincial constables of the BCSPCA can lawfully enter a vehicle.
I think the RCMP can too, yes, though, right? And the Vancouver Police. I'm pretty sure, yes, I've heard of them breaking into cars before.
What happens sometimes is the person returns to their vehicle before those people arrive. So I stay around to give them a piece of my mind.
You know, I saw a story on the news lately. This was a U.S. story. I think it was just last week, where a dog was rescued from a hot car in a parking lot. And one of the tips given was that you can actually buy a device that is used to shatter glass. And if you have one handy on you, like you keep it in your car, I'm just saying that this device exists. If you want to save a life, I'm thinking of getting one. I was just reminded of this now. It's, can't remember what it's called, but it looks like a taser or something. It's like a taser for glass, and you just put it on the window, and it safely shatters the window so that you don't have to get injured or cut, right? And then you can just open the window. Anyways, I'm just saying that's what I would do if there was an animal in need.
Yeah, and also I like to keep a little kit in my car, like an extra bottle of water, small bowl, a towel that can be soaked in water. So if the vehicle has the window open a bit, you can put that through to give to the animal.
Great.
You can also help raise awareness by printing out copies of the infographic, Hot Pets Not Cool, and you can go put them around like shopping malls and stuff.
Awesome.
Yeah. I wonder if we can put a copy of that like on our Facebook or our website. I've seen it before, mm-hmm, and now that it's a hot summer again, I want to print out a bunch of those and just always have them on me, because you need to be prepared for these situations, just because the guardians of some animals aren't.
And can I add one quick tip? If I'm walking anywhere and there's a parking lot nearby, I'll take a quick detour through there and look for dogs and cars. I always do this in the summer. You wouldn't believe how common this is.
Yeah, I do that too.
Thank you. Do you have another news story?
The other news story is, it's pretty exciting. The draft for the guidelines for the new Canada Food Guide is out. It's just a draft. So we need more people to take the survey. And that's at the foodguideconsultation.ca website. It's also posted on Animal Voices Vancouver. There's some pretty exciting things so far. The milk category has gone.
Good.
Isn't that crazy?
Good. Can I say something about
this? Yes, you can.
I've been at 3 doctor's appointments this week, and every time I am noticing these brochures by the milk and the egg industry all over the doctor's office with lies printed in them. And they're talking about how these are healthy foods. They're the source of your calcium and your protein that is optimal. And our frequent guest on our show, Anna Pippis, who's an animal rights lawyer, has taken on the dairy industry for their misleading ads saying that it would prevent osteoporosis. That was last fall, I believe. And I have the flyer in front of me from the egg industry, and it says, if you're healthy and eating a well-balanced diet, you don't have to limit dietary cholesterol. In fact, avoiding nutrient foods like eggs, lean meats, and dairy products may actually do you more harm than good because it deprives your body of nutrients you need for good health. If you look up Dr. Michael Greger on nutritionfacts.org, he refutes all of these claims with the latest medical studies. These are absolute lies. And he also says that eggs cannot legally be called a health food because they are so high in cholesterol and trans fats. So they get very creative in the egg industry with trying to use other words to imply that it's nutritious, and they keep getting shut down by the government because they say, no, you cannot call them healthy.
It shows how powerful they are. I mean, the glossy prints that you find in a doctor's office, you assume are going to be the truth.
You would think that if it's coming from your doctor and your doctor approved those to be there, that you can take their word for it. And doctors are not well educated on nutrition, and they know this. So end of my rant. Sorry. Here we go. Any other news stories?
That's it.
That's it. Okay. Well, anyway, how have you both experienced maybe talking to your doctors about health? I know I have friends who've gone into medical offices, and when they see this paraphernalia, they do address it. And have you got an experience with that? Have you done that with your doctors?
No, I had a doctor from when I was little, who he was from England, and he always said that dairy was not good, that dairy is made for the mother cow, not for people. And so he advocated for not
it's drinking
milk.
It's known to be one of the number one allergens in humans, right? Of course, it's not for our species. Allison, how about you? What are you like with your doctor on these issues?
Yeah, well, I see many doctors, it seems like, where I have been lately, because I've been trying to get second and third and fourth opinions on problems that I've been having. But anyways, I always have, I buy many copies of the China study whenever I see them at secondhand stores, and because there's a lot of them there. It's a very famous book by Dr. T. Colin Campbell, and it's the study, it's the longest ever study done on human nutrition that was carried over 30 years, and definitely talks about how dairy correlates with turning on cancer cells. And he's a microbiologist, I believe. Anyways, some type of biologist. And anyways, he's a doctor. And I think, and it's a very scientific book, if either of you have read it. And that's the kind of book that I want to give out to doctors. So I'm going to make it a point to give that one out. My naturopath hadn't heard of it. So I'm surprised when people haven't, I'm surprised when doctors haven't heard of the book, The China Study. It should be required reading for any medical doctor, I would think. So
yeah,
there's a tip, is buy them and give them out. And yeah, I've just been thinking of that in the last week, thinking I need to give this doctor one and this doctor one. And even if they don't read it, at least they have it as a resource on their library bookshelf. And maybe they will read it one day. At least they have the information. Don't assume that they already know about what's in there and about correlations between disease and dairy and meat, because I've been learning that doctors just don't know everything. You think they would. I've had to learn to be my own doctor lately and actually cure myself of an illness this past week that had been plaguing me for 2.5 months. That, like, why did I have to figure out how to fix myself? None of the doctors could help me. So that's really opened my eyes to really realize that you need to be your own health advocate and educate yourself.
Exactly.
And read, watch documentaries. I know both of you were talking earlier today about the new documentary film What the Health. That documentary's opened a lot of people's eyes, and there's other ones like it. Forks Over Knives is one that comes to mind, and there's the new one that we are talking about. I can't remember what it's called, but James Cameron is the executive producer. Mm-hmm. And it's also going to be on a similar line of health and diet. You need to educate yourself on these issues and be open to watching talks on YouTube, for example, or you know, things that that people like me and Jen and Jillian, if we're your Facebook friends, that we're constantly putting on Facebook, hoping that someone will you know, someone who really needs it will watch what we're posting and will get something out of it.
If you're my Facebook friend and you're not vegan yet, I don't know what's wrong with you, because I give education from every angle: the climate issue, the health issue, animal rights. I mean, I leave people no out, and I'm not trying to be pushy about it. I'm providing education, and I cannot imagine my pre-vegan self being exposed to the kinds of things that I post on social media and not going vegan. I mean, it was never presented to me in this way, which is why it took me until 3.5 years ago to make this change. And of course, I wish I did it sooner, but with all that information, there's just no argument. In fact, let's talk about James Aspie for a minute. We mentioned him earlier in the show, and he will be on the show soon. I'm going to be interviewing him. So he is a vegan animal rights activist from Australia, and he films his debates with non-vegans. And it's really interesting to watch, because as vegan animal rights activists ourselves, we can see ourselves in those positions. We've been there. We've heard those arguments. Some of the arguments are so stupid that you think people are making it up just to bother us. And he's in a discussion with someone who is constantly giving him these arguments. And it's like James is in a batting cage, just hitting every single ball back at him. And the guy says to him, "You've got an answer for everything." And James says, "There is an answer for everything."
I know, there is.
And he's right. Like, he's just smiling, like, "Well, I'm not trying to be cocky here. There just is an answer for everything." And the guy said, "Well, you've given me something to think about. So if I think of another argument, I might call you later." And then James just kind of laughs and goes, "I'll be sitting right by the phone," because he's just so relentless. And it's so time consuming. I wish people would look up vegansidekick.com. That has all the probably 50 most common arguments against veganism. And as animal rights activists, it can save you a lot of time when you're having these debates with people. Just send them that website.
Also the new Canada Food Guide. Can you imagine? That's going to be a huge shift, because it's really promoted in the school system. And I grew up with that category, that milk category and the meat category. So having the new An improved food guide, I think, is going to really change people's minds.
It will. Yeah.
It will, because people listen to the government and they think that, you know, the government and doctors know everything. But at least it is a step forward in the right direction, knowing that at least we have our government is starting to shift in that direction, where we can actually trust the facts and the information that they have to present. Because we know all about it, but we had to learn ourselves, right? And that's not, I don't know, it's just like in a society where we're supposed to be educated, we live in a first world here with access to all kinds of information. You would think people would know the truth about things like that, but unfortunately they don't.
If I had children, the first thing I would teach them would be, don't trust the government. I wish I was taught that when I was younger.
Question everything.
Question what people have to gain from telling you what they do. Like these brochures I found in my doctor's office.
Who are they
funded by? If you look on the back
of
them, they're funded by the egg and the dairy industries. They have no business being in a doctor's office. And actually, the doctor I spoke with today was cool about it. He agreed. And I said, look, I understand that you're not at the front desk most of the day. And when these people come in to put their paraphernalia out, you're not able to do anything. But I had a purse load of the stuff, so he knows that I'm taking it out. And I'm replacing it with my vegan stuff. I always have vegan information in my purse, and I leave it around town in the most strategic locations. And I encourage everyone else to do the same.
Yeah, that's really smart. We've started a little, there's a stockpile of brochures now at my gym when you walk in.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got like a box of Compassionate Athlete booklets in my living room, and one day I'm going to bring them, like every day I go to the gym, I'm just going to leave a pile there and see how many get taken, because I'm looking at all these other brochures for like fast food restaurants. I'm like, yeah, like if they'll take those ones, why wouldn't they take mine that has a picture of David Carter, the 300-pound vegan athlete,
on
the
front?
Oh, that's
perfect for the gym.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, exactly. It's geared towards people like that who go to my gym. And I think that that, yeah. And I love your Dr. Vism or whatever you call it. I've been seeing that a lot lately on your Facebook, Jen.
Yeah, for those who don't know what Allison's talking about, I got my start on Animal Voices because I was a guest because I have something I call Tinder Vism. Yeah. So I'll advocate wherever I am and then I just call it fill in the blank Vism. If I'm on an airplane, it's airplane Vism. I'm leaving brochures and opening minds. So yeah, do it, please. We're just spreading the truth. We live in a very brainwashed society where the big corporations dominate and people are believing these things that they hear. And we have to fight against that from a grassroots kind of level.
Absolutely. Jen, do we have any more time to speak about heart stroke in pets?
Yeah, let's go back to the dogs in cars situation. Go ahead, Jillian.
So another thing to be mindful of in the summer is heat stroke. So if you notice that your pet has exaggerated panting or the sudden stopping of panting, rapid or erratic pulse, salivation, anxious or staring expression, weakness and muscle tremors, lack of coordination, convulsions or vomiting, and collapse, you need to immediately contact your vet. As well as there's some things you can do is feed them some cool water. Definitely don't give them ice cubes because that stops the blood flow. And
Good to know.
Yeah, and fan them until you can get them to a vet.
Mm-hmm. And just generally, don't bring your dog out if you're going to be doing things that day. If you're doing errands and you need to leave your car unattended, your dog's better off at home. I think a lot of people are thinking, well, they're going to be lonely, but I walk by so many cars with dogs in them and I'm just,
it's crazy.
I got into an argument with a guy in a parking lot recently and everybody in the vicinity backed him up and I thought, wow, there's a dog in a hot car. And everyone here is defending
That's
it.
That's why you need to have those brochures to give out.
I know.
And exactly. I need to look that up because it's very basic and gives the information that a lot of people... I've seen like arguments online, just as you were saying, of people trying to save animals and then dogs that were in the car and then the guardian coming, running over and just like yelling and like, oh, you don't know what you're doing. And actually the one that I spoke about, the news story that I saw last week, the owner was just very blasé and didn't seem to care. Oh, and there was one that actually happened locally where the guardian left his dog in the car and he had a remote control for the air conditioning in the car that he thought he kept putting on every once in a while, but it turns out it wasn't working. Mm. And that poor dog was foaming at the mouth and almost died. And that was a local save here in the Vancouver area.
They shouldn't get their animals back if this happens. And here's another tip, everybody, because this is often a situation where someone's popping into the grocery store. The first thing I do is I take a picture of the car, the dog in it, and the license plate, because it's pretty likely that the person's going to come back to the vehicle before the emergency help arrives. The SPCA is very busy and rarely has time to get somewhere within that kind of a timeline. It's not too late to send in that information after the vehicle disappears, which is what I had to do recently when this fellow left his dog in the car. He saw me taking a picture. He was sitting in Subway having a sandwich and he came out and started yelling at me. And so I called the SPCA and I said he left 10 minutes ago, but here's his license. And they said, we are going to follow up.
Good
and
for you.
At least that person now has sort of a mark on their file. If someone else calls again, perhaps there can be charges. I don't know enough about how the SPCA works to say if there will be or not, but please take action.
Yeah, people really need to think about their pets instead of themselves. Like my dog can't be at home. She has major anxiety. So I have to take her pretty much everywhere. But in the summer, I really have to plan what we're going to do. Like some days I just won't be able to do what I really want to do.
Exactly.
Or we might have to walk somewhere instead of riding in the car.
Right. Or leave it at a friend's house if you want your dog out in the backyard.
You wouldn't leave your human child in your car because we know how hot it is. Mm-hmm. And actually that story I was talking about just here locally with the air conditioning that didn't work, they actually put the guardian, the human, inside the car to see if he could last in there a few minutes and he couldn't.
Good.
He had to get out.
Good. That sometimes people need that to understand how hot it gets. Well, that concludes our show today. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download shows as podcasts, read our show blog with detailed links, and subscribe via iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And all those videos that we talk about that can easily veganize you are always posted up on Animal Voices Vancouver. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices today. And remember to be kind to the animals. And Allison, what do we have on next week's show?
Next week, we have Mexican superstar, celebrity, and animal rights advocate Marco Antonio Regil. He'll be speaking on issues to do with animals in Mexico. And then we'll also be doing a segment on the use of animal idioms in language.
Great. And we are going to be closing today with a song by Peter Tosh called Down Presser Man. And I am dedicating this to those who are testing on lab animals and they know that it's ineffective and they're doing it because it gets them funding money. It's about the fact that elites have oppressed and exploited people in nature throughout history and will have to suffer for their consequences of their actions. And in the end, we reap what we sow and there is nowhere to run to. So enjoy this song by Peter Tosh.
Under your